Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the first in a new series of podcasts from the Investors Chronicle. My name is Alex Newman, an associate editor at the magazine, and I'll be your host for what is a slightly different format to the episodes that normally appear in your podcast feed. Its main difference, other than being recorded monthly, is that the questions aren't being fielded by a commentator or fund manager, but by someone who has lived and breathed investing on their own account for more than six decades. As we often write in the magazine, nothing beats skin in the game, and Lord Lee of Trafford has been in the game more than almost anyone actively investing in the UK today. John, as I'll call him, is a former MP, minister and High Sheriff of Manchester, and now a serving member in the House of Lords. And he's probably the UK's best known self-directed investor. In 2003, he disclosed that the value of his ISA portfolio had then reached £1 million, becoming the first retail investor to reach that landmark. And he has documented his investing life in hundreds of articles for the Financial Times and in a book, How to Make a Million Slowly. So the plan for this series, which we've called Lee in the IC, is that it will be an extended conversation with John, drawing on his decades of practical and personal experience as an investor. We'll discuss his thoughts on various UK companies and market trends, his investing principles, and I hope his take on some bigger topics too. I should add at this point that though we will be talking about individual stocks and John's portfolio in detail, this podcast is purely for educational purposes, and nothing in it should be taken as financial advice or recommendations to buy or sell shares. Finally, I also hope that it can serve as a source of optimism and a bit of an antidote to the narrative of UK market decline. Not, I should add, because this isn't a real concern, it is, but because this often obscures the fact that there are lots of great homegrown UK listed companies out there to talk about, and that while improvements to markets and business is something we can all hope and agitate for, what matters to investors is navigating the here and now. So speaking of the here and now, let's get to it. John, a very warm welcome to you today in the studio. How are you?
Thank you, Alex. Absolutely fine. Looking forward to the first, hopefully, of many similar talks.
I'm really excited too. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So this week, without further ado, we're going to be discussing dividends, the resilience of the city, and a few smaller holdings in your portfolio. But I want to start with one of the companies which I understand is now one of your largest positions. And that's the FTSE 100 asset manager cum life insurer M&G, which, as it so happens, just published interim results for the half year to June 2023. John, could you sort of briefly sketch out for me the M&G backstory and also your story with M&G, how you came to be invested in the company?
Well, M&G, of course, has been a household name, a major name in fund management for years and years. What, 3 or 4 years ago, maybe even a little longer, it was spun off by the Pru and came to the market as a standalone separate entity. I have to say, no one was quite sure what it was, how to describe it, really, because it was a mix, and it still is a mix in a way, of wealth manager and annuity holder. And it came to the market, and really, I think it would be fair to say that it's never really become a favourite in investors' eyes. I described it as a little bit of a stranded whale in an odd sort of way. And the previous chief executive, I think, stewarded it fairly carefully, but there was no real image to it. And people weren't sure what sort of future it had. But it had a very attractive yield and has a very attractive yield, which no doubt we'll talk about. And it seemed to me to be an almost hedge you win, tails you can't lose situation, in that there was a dividend yield and still is of around 10%. And also it's fairly frequently talked about, and indeed was talked about in the newspapers this week, as a possible takeover candidate. And so, to my mind, something that has the size and stature of M&G and the dividend yield and the possibility of a takeover really made it a very interesting situation. And so I went along to the AGM this year to really try and get a feel of the company, because I hadn't had a feel of it, and to get a feel also of the new chief executive, Andrea Rossi, and the chairman, the relatively new chairman as well, and hopefully to talk to one or two members of the board and indeed one or two of the shareholders. And I certainly wasn't disappointed. I'm a great believer in AGM attendance, although I don't attend as many as I did these days, but M&G was important, and M&G had a hybrid AGM, which is what I favour these days, so the physical attendance and also by Zoom as well.
Sure.
In digital form, and that's one of the reasons why I was totally opposed to Archie Norman's M&S attempt to make the AGM all digital and exclude people, which I thought was totally wrong. Anyway, during the course of the meeting, Andrea Rossi talked very optimistically about the future of M&G, and afterwards I was able to talk to him and to the chairman, and I got the feeling of quiet optimism and a feeling also that the dividend was secure. And I also met a significant investor called Kingdom Holdings, which is a Saudi group who own about 6%, and they'd been building up their stake. And then I met one or two of the other directors as well. Overall, I came away feeling, you know, this is really a company with a considerable future, very little downside. And I like the dividend yield, and it's a 4 billion plus capitalization, ticks a lot of boxes.
Yeah.
So I went away and significantly increased my holding in M&G. And in fact, I sold most of my Aviva shares and bought more M&G.
Interesting. So just to jump back to the start, were you an M&G holder because of the pre spin out? Did you just hang on to your shares?
No, I didn't. I came in, I suppose, about maybe 18 months ago, something like that.
Okay.
But as a result of attending the AGM and forming a very positive view, I significantly increased my stake, and it's probably now my second largest holding, second to Treat.
Yeah. So you've got quite modest optimism at the board level. Your confidence. We do also have the fact you alluded to is that there's I suppose been this perpetual market doubt a little bit about M&G. Just to sort of really focus on the blocks of the business here. You know, this is like all life insurers. This business with some quite complex moving parts, I suppose. So you have the wealth division that's trying to grow through the PruFund franchise, this fixed income focused asset manager, which faces some big headwinds, but you know, Andrea Rossi's talked about it being, you know, potentially a European powerhouse. Then you've got this kind of pension arm, which is, you know, there's definite growth there, though it's quite capital intensive. And then the closed book heritage life insurance business that's in runoff. I suppose you may have sort of three or four parts here. Does that amount to you in your eyes as a growth business, or is it kind of like hold steady?
Well, certainly Rossi, who I subsequently had lunch with, believes that it provides an almost unique platform to move forward.
As a kind of cross-selling.
The cross-selling and the overall financial strength of the group. And I think he believes, and I go along with it, that it puts them in a unique position. And I think if you really put his previous experience and track record at AXA alongside the fundamentals of M&G, you have a very attractive combination. And I was probably, in my earlier comments, a shade underplaying Ross's optimism and enthusiasm. He really does believe that he's going to build a very significant global business. And I think it's very much, you know, watch this space. And I was very pleased with the interim results that came through a few days ago. I would have been personally very happy with a maintained interim dividend, instead of which was put up 5%. So the yield is back now to around 10%, which for a company of that size and stature, frankly, is extraordinary.
It's unusual. I suppose the dividend is one headline that investors will look to whenever they open M&G's results. There are a few other elements, though. I suppose in hitting those targets, what should investors be looking at from sort of the major headline metrics for more reassurance? You know, there's obviously the kind of capital solvency, sort of client flows, statutory profits, adjusted profits. What are the moving parts that you are?
Well, I think fundamentally with that sort of business, you want to see a really good solvency ratio, and right. I think it's around 200%, which I think is
twice the capital, the regulatory capital need.
Exactly, is excellent. An optimistic vein through the group comments. The 5% increase in the interim dividend, and the talk also not just regarding the annuity side as effectively sort of closed end and runoff,
right,
but actually indicating plans to really take in new business,
yeah,
in that area as well. And I think also Rossi believes with his international connections that he can bring in significant new investment management mandates from around the world. So, you know, it all seems to me to be pointing in one direction.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, so long as that dividend is maintained, that's a happy picture for M&G investors. Obviously, investors don't have to answer the question of the disconnect around the rating. But, what, you know, to your eyes, are some of the explanations for why the market does seem a little bit nervous about, you know, because 10%, a 10% dividend yield tends to be
normally, if you saw 10%, warning lights would flash.
Yeah.
But first of all, I would say that in that whole sector, there are some very attractive yields. So you can get, and I think these yields are extraordinary. You can get an 8% dividend yield on Legal & General. You can get similar on Aviva. You can get 9% on Phoenix, mm-hmm, and similarly with Chesnara as well, all of which I've got.
Mm-hmm.
So the 10% in that context, in that sectoral context, is not exceptional.
Okay,
you know, if you saw all the rest of the market and that sector on yields of 3% and 4%, and you saw M&G on 10%, you might think, well, something's wrong. So I think relative to its sector, it's not standing out, as it were. But I think in terms of the opportunities for further growth and from a potential takeover point of view, you know, if it doesn't actually deliver the growth and therefore remains a bit of a stranded whale, then I suspect consolidation and predators may well appear.
Yeah. So I'm on that point, and who might, you know, potentially harpoon this slightly stranded whale there, you know, the bid talk that you refer to, I think there were rumours in late February that it might be a takeover target. Then there was a story that Macquarie
was certainly mentioned. Whether they could do it alone, I think there was some talk of you know, maybe Macquarie, you know, working together with who knows who, maybe, I don't know, Phoenix or what have you. But of course, you know, there are some very substantial fund managers in the US and Europe as well, who if they really wanted to build up in the UK, would see, I would suggest, you know, M&G as a very, very attractive and significantly sized target and platform to go for. You know, it all to me ticks all the boxes.
Yeah, and I suppose we should state as well, the company said that it can go it alone. I mean, maybe sort of broadening this out to a bit more of your longer investing track record. I think you told me that before that you've seen in your portfolio something like 60 plus takeover situations in your career as an investor that you've benefited from. When talk about bid activity surfaces in a holding, do you normally see that as a positive, or is it potentially points to nerves around strategy or how investors see it, or is it a good thing with a kind of nice underpinning for the share price?
Because I see it as the latter.
Right.
I see it as an undervalued opportunity. Therefore, you know, I think the onus is on Andrea Rossi and the team to move it forward, to develop a premium rating for it.
Yeah.
You know, clearly, if they don't, then there is that obvious vulnerability.
Yeah. So M&G being a big income holding of yours, it brings us sort of neatly to the broader investing theme that I wanted to talk about with you this month, which is dividends. I think it's fair to say that, you know, distributions from companies is, you know, really key to your investing outlook. Why are you such a fan, John?
A fan of dividends?
Yeah.
For a whole mix of reasons, you know, obviously, you know, in pure cash terms, they're nice to have.
Mm-hmm.
And in my ISA and the precursor to that, the PEPs that I had from 87, I think, when PEPs first started, the reinvestment of dividends and the compounding has played a significant part in the overall growth. I've never attempted to work it out mathematically, but it's been significant. And there've been a whole range of studies done which indicate that a significant part of portfolio growth has come about through the reinvestment of dividends. So I've always looked for a dividend yield. When a dividend is declared by a company, in a sense, it's telling us three things. It's telling us, or commenting on, the results of the last year. It's taking a view as to results for the next year, because obviously management have any sense, they don't want to cut the dividend, as it were, so they want to feel it in a position to at least maintain it. And thirdly, what it means is that the company actually has got the cash to pay the dividend, which is a great plus. And so the profits are real profits and are cash profits, or at least the liquidity is there to pay the dividend. So, you know, those are important aspects. Then, of course, a dividend provides a prop to a share price, fairly obviously. How the dividend yield, clearly the increase in attraction, and one hopes that, share price moves up. I mean, if I, just jobbing back to M&G, for example, I would suggest that M&G, in my judgment, should be on a dividend yield of about 6.5%, even 7%, say, rather than 10%. So I think that there is that significant capital appreciation that should be there, almost before the company actually starts, hopefully, moving forward and growing profits. The other point on dividends, Alex, is that I've frequently focused my investment approach on buying into what I term proprietorial companies, where there is a big family stake. And there are a number of those that over the years have performed extremely well. And many investors and listeners will know of them. Firms like Halstead's and Nichols and Latham's and F.W. Thorpe. These are sort of classic Goodwins, classic family businesses. And the whole point about investing in that type of business is that the word that I like is stewardship. In other words, the generation running the business are conscious of the history of the business and their inheritance, but obviously want to move it forward, but move the business forward sensibly without taking absurd risks and risking everything. And also, many of those companies are conscious of members of the family who've got big share stakes, but earn no salary from the company. They're not on the board, in other words. They've got no executive role. And therefore, the dividend is important to them in terms of maintaining their lifestyle. Mm. So there is, in a sense, an additional motivation for that type of company to pay dividends and hopefully pay an increasing rate of dividends as well.
Almost as a trust, in a sense.
Correct, yeah. Correct. I mean, it's almost an inheritance and the family, the ongoing family responsibility, yeah, to look after the wider members, and of course shareholders benefit as well.
Yeah. Just to play devil's advocate, kick the tires of the theory. I mean, there's some of the companies that have been most successful in recent times. I'm particularly thinking on the other side of the pond, where, granted, the attitude towards dividends does differ a little from UK equity income investors. You've had some enormously successful businesses which don't pay dividends at all. You know, the likes of Amazon, Google's parent Alphabet, Berkshire Hathaway, two of those companies.
Sure, the big American tech stock.
Yeah, I mean, two of those companies, I suppose, with Berkshire and Amazon, have had a degree of family control. But the attitude or the investment philosophy with owning those stocks is one of a sort of total return of portfolio appreciation. Would you ever consider investing in a company that didn't?
Oh yes, I mean, I've got a number of companies where the dividend yield at the moment is very low. Companies, right, like Manolete, for example, and Vionet, mm-hmm, a company which I like very much called Concurrent Technologies, who passed their dividend during the more difficult period with the, mm-hmm, with the supply of components, mm-hmm, and now coming back very, very strongly indeed. So the dividends are not an absolute, but overall, I do like them. And of course, the beauty about having a portfolio now with the M&Gs and the Avivas and the Legal & Generals and the Phoenixes, that such is the size of dividend income that they produce, then one can afford in the portfolio to carry a few low-yielding or non-yielding shares, as it were, but still overall producing the income for reinvestment or for spend that one wants.
Yeah. Has your attitude to dividends changed over the years? And I suppose it's a very personal question about, you know, personal finances, but there is, I suppose, in the kind of capital or the accumulation stage of some investors' lives, there is not necessarily a need to take the dividend as income, but just let it be reinvested back into investments. Has your philosophy changed at all? As you know, perhaps your sort of need from dividends changed?
It's not a change. By and large, I've, apart from a very short period, I've pretty well reinvested the dividends, and I'm still doing that. Mm. Who knows in the future? You know, with things like expensive care homes. I mean, I'm in my 80s now, so one has to think about that sort of thing, and possibly grandchildren's school fees and all that. You know, things can change a little. But the answer really is that I haven't changed my fundamental philosophy. That I've tried to build my portfolios, the ISA portfolio particularly, over the years, brick by brick, on a conservative basis. Mm. And of course, the key to successful portfolio investment is avoiding the losses. And so I've not been looking and chasing spectacular returns. And I certainly confess that I missed out on the, you know, on the American growth in those big tech stocks. But then, of course, you know, I really only focus on UK equities. It's a market that I think I understand, mm-hmm. and where I know the established companies well, and endeavour to avoid mistakes. Now, we all make mistakes. Of course, I've made mistakes and will make mistakes in the future. But, you know, what really one's honed one's approach over the years, and essentially it's conservative. At the present time, not only the high yielding stocks that we've talked about, but so many of the others are very undervalued, significantly undervalued as compared with US stocks, and historically so as well. And of course, you know, that's why we're seeing, when we see takeovers coming in, we're seeing takeover premiums of 30-40% and upwards on existing levels.
Yeah, I suppose just to unwind some of my devil's advocacy there, and you know, just looking back at M&G, and interestingly, you know, since it listed in the autumn of 2019, you know, we've obviously had some very, very rocky markets at the beginning of its listing life. But the top slicing, you know, in the total return sense, might not have worked had you needed the income from an M&G, because its share price, you know, has been fairly volatile. And the dividend has been a lot more consistent than its share price, particularly in a bear market. That's something to think about. Just moving on, perhaps M&G is, I suppose, emblematic of a broader point around UK equities. Maybe the chair of the City of the London Investment Trust said earlier this week that UK equities, you know, offered the chance for investors to be paid to hold on. I don't know if that's, you know, reassuring or damning with faint praise in a way, but it does bring us to another topic I wanted to touch on today, John, and that's on, I suppose, City or the UK investment market resilience. I'm sure, you know, it won't have escaped your attention that the main narrative around the UK stock market and the City currently is around managed or mismanaged decline. What do you make of the current landscape and that narrative that we have?
Well, a number of points, Alex. First of all, you know, we've just agreed present prices are very low historically, and I think it's a very attractive point of entry for investors, particularly via an ISA or similar, where there are tax free advantages. I just think that there are great opportunities, and to me, and it should be very depressing to government to appreciate that now, as I understand it, more young people speculate, and I don't say invest. It's speculating cryptocurrencies than invest in traditional equities or in traditional form, and I think that's very worrying. And I think it's a huge indictment of the lack of financial education in this country from schools onwards. One of the areas of blame, in my judgment, is the total failure, the near total failure of television to cover which after all has been the, you know, the dominant media until very recently, and certainly is the dominant media for those maybe slightly more mature people with surplus cash and similar to invest. Total failure of television to cover the stock market, investment opportunities. There's so many great British companies that one can invest in. And I think it's just an absolute tragedy that, that those opportunities are not brought into people's homes on any sort of basis at all. And I think, for me, it's been a tragedy in recent years when interest rates have been so low that you've had so many thousands of people with cash in the bank. I know a lot of people are struggling at the moment. Of course they are, but they're also quite a lot with savings. So for years, they've had money in the bank, earning next to nothing until interest rates started to rise very recently. And yet they could have invested in solid UK companies earning an attractive, positive return. And we have to ask ourselves, why have they failed? I think also that sadly, there is a mystique about stock market investment. And that's why so many people feel that they need to invest and should invest, if they're going to invest, through funds rather than take the decisions themselves. I've always tried to encourage, I'd like to think I've been an evangelist for the private investor, trying to encourage people to take more decisions themselves. And it's not rocket science. I mean, you only need, apart from obviously some money, you only need two things, in my judgment, to be a successful investor: common sense and patience. Those are the only two. Common sense and patience. And it's patience probably the most important. And that's what most people lack. Successful investment is about getting into good companies and staying with them, being patient and letting hopefully those businesses grow in capital value and in dividend paying terms as well. You don't make much money. You're not going to become wealthy jumping about from this to that and taking small profits. The big money is made by getting into good things and staying with them long term.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose, one wonders if, patience and television as bedfellows aren't necessarily, don't necessarily naturally go together. But the broader question I'd be interested in, your thoughts on the, one reluctance maybe of television or whatever media it might be to properly communicate, the value of person investing. Could it be demand in a way? Is there a cultural aversion to risk taking in the UK? Do you think that we put investing in the same bracket as gambling?
I wouldn't say gambling, although the interesting thing, of course, is that there are any number of advertisements allowed and carried by television companies for gambling, as it were. And yet, is there anything in terms of traditional investing or on the great British companies that you can invest in? I think there is a degree of risk aversion in the UK. But I mean, we have so many excellent companies. And even if you take it, for example, there is a company like the programme like Dragon's Den, for example, which is a very substantial viewing audience. People are interested in business. People are interested in those who made a success of businesses and have become wealthy through legitimate means. And I just think it's an absolute tragedy that so many of the great British companies that are out there that one can invest in aren't really brought to the attention of your average person. And I think part of the problem is that society and government, in terms of endeavouring to protect consumers and protect investors from, and of course they must be protected from gross abuse. I think that we've become too restrictive and too much risk averse. I mean, our great trading companies, aren't going to be built, by the efforts of the Financial Conduct Authority or the Competition and Markets Authority, as it were. We've got to liberate business And I think also liberate the potential investment community. There is a great latent opportunity in this country for investors, both institutional and private, you know, to back a number of these smaller companies, some of which will, I'm sure, grow to be very, very sizable companies. Mm. And hopefully many will grow and not be taken over. I mean, you mentioned that I've been on the receiving end, as I have, of sort of 60 takeovers or take privates during my investing years. Most of them have obviously produced a short-term premium on existing prices. But some of them, in my judgment, would have proved outstanding investments over the years had they been allowed to continue.
The ones that got away.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that there has been a little too much of sort of selling out too soon from some very great UK companies.
I mean, sure, these are, you know, big themes and big questions we'll be coming back to in the coming months. On the subject of smaller companies, just to round off our discussion and wrap up for this month, I just wanted to touch on a couple of companies which you did mention in your recent FT Money article. Actually, you touched on briefly earlier. I mean, one of them, Concurrent Technologies, which you have a holding in.
A significant holding.
A firm I have to say I didn't know too much about until I looked them up. But I mean, in the sometimes desperate search for UK technology leading lights, this is fairly below the radar, but one you've been a fan of for a while. What's the business?
The business basically is computer boards of a very rugged and enduring, can't fail nature.
Right.
So really very specialised, and always a very big export into the US particularly. And so historically they've been, I think, on a number of the major and latest American sort of space and missile programs. That has increased recently. And so their export now is about 90% from their Colchester base, 90% globally. But America, of course, is a very big market indeed. And 70%, 73%, I think, of their overall revenues were defence orientated. Mm. And I think that is likely to increase. Of course, you mentioned under the radar. The problem is that when commentators in this country talk about defence and defence sector, their knowledge pretty well stops at BAE Systems and Kinetic and maybe Schemring or one or two others, as it were. They really aren't focused on a number of the smaller companies that are there that actually are very focused indeed on defence. So Concurrent had a difficult period, particularly with the semiconductor supply problems.
The shortage of...
shortage of those, which really held them back significantly. So they had a difficult 12, 15 months and passed the dividend. They have now got he's been there 2 or 3 years, a new chief executive called Miles Adcock, who's got a big company background, and he's changed things dramatically in the company, brought in a lot of new people, increased the product lines. They've just made an acquisition in the US, which, of course, is particularly important in terms of getting contracts for, from the US defence sector. And in my judgment, this is going to be, really quite a significant company in 2 or 3 years' time. So I'm very confident that it's on an upward trend. And similarly, with a big defence interest, I've also written and visited Goodwins in the Potteries, which is an outstanding family-dominated firm with substantial focus on both nuclear decommissioning for the Sellafields of this world and submarine construction, both UK and American submarines, very important supplier. And we've got clearly increased expenditure going into the whole submarine world. We've got the AUKUS program coming up in a few years' time as well. So they're going to be very well placed, in my judgment, to grow profits. And it's an extremely well-regarded company. So as examples, to me, both Concurrent and Goodwins both of which are significant holdings in my portfolio, you know, I'm very confident that they will deliver over the next few years.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you know, never forget the smaller suppliers. I think it's always an important watchword in investing. These are both businesses, I suppose, concurrent, you know, headwinds they faced in this, you know, with their supply chain, but also the nature of you know, big contracting is, I suppose, one bear point potentially for these smaller businesses, that you can become quite over reliant on a few big clients. That said, I was looking at Goodwin's, and they, you know, the last 20 years they've compounded at an average of 20%, including dividends, makes them kind of one of the real leaders in the entire market, and also one of those family companies that you were.
They're an exceptional business. I was slow to become aware of them. I should have invested years ago, but I visited them. I had built up a small stake in it and visited them about 3 months ago. Mm. Probably one of the most impressive companies that I've ever visited. And to find, I think in this case, four members of the family, all of whom are absolutely driven to build a business and take it up to the next stage, is something quite unique. You know, usually in family businesses, you find, you know, maybe with luck, they've got one member of the family business who really drives it, as it were, and then, you know, one or two gentlemen on the board. Mm. But in this case, all the members of the family, they were in different divisions and chairman, they all were absolutely committed to moving the business forward. So, those two are current favourites of mine, amongst others.
Yeah, and good to focus on a Stoke headquartered company that isn't Bet365 as well, I suppose.
Yeah. I think that's fair comment.
Lovely. I mean, loads to unpack for future episodes. It'd be interesting to hear next time, John, what your investor diary over the coming month brings us to talk about. But I think on that note, we should probably wrap up. I should say, if there are questions you'd like to ask John or subjects you'd like us to cover in future episodes, please email me at alex.newman@ft.com and we'll do our best to address them. But until then, all that's left for me to say is thanks to you for listening. Thank you very much, John, for your thoughts.
My pleasure.
And thanks to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe, for all her work behind the soundboard. Until next time.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.